Chapter 14. God's Building the New Orphan Houses. How complex are the movements of God's providence? Some events are themselves eventful. Like the wheels in Ezekiel's vision, a wheel in the middle of a wheel, they involve other issues within their mysterious mechanism, and constitute epochs of history. Such an epochal event was the building of the first new orphan house in Ashley Down. After October 1845, it became clear to Mr. Mueller that the Lord was leading in this direction. Residents in Wilson Street had raised objections to the noise made by the children, especially in play hours. The playgrounds were no longer large enough for so many orphans. The drainage was not adequate, nor was the situation of rented houses favorable for properly sanitation conditions. It was also desirable to secure ground for cultivation, and thus supply outdoor work for the boys, etc. Such were some of the reasons which seemed demanded the building of a new orphan house, and the conviction steadily gained ground that the highest well-being all concerned would be largely promoted if a suitable site could be found in which erect a building adapted to the purpose. There were objections to building which were carefully weighed. Money and large sums would be needed. Planning and construction would severely tax time and strength. Wisdom and oversight would be demanded in each stage of the work, and question arose whether such permanent structures benefits God's pilgrim people who have here no continuing city and believing that the end of all things is at hand. Continuance in prayer, however, brought a sense of quiet and restful conviction that all obligations were overbalanced by other favorable considerations. One argument seemed particularly weighty. Should God provide large amount of money for this purpose, it would still further illustrate the power of prayer offered in faith. To command help from on high, a land of ground spacious enough would at the outset cost thousands of pounds. But why should this daunt the true child of God whose father is infinitely rich? Mr. Mueller and his helpers sought day by day to be guided of God, and as faith fed this daily bread of contact with him, the assurance grew strong that help would come. Shortly, Mr. Mueller was as sure of this as though the building already stood before his eyes. Through for 5 weeks, not one penny had been sent in for this purpose. Meanwhile, there were sent on that searching scrutiny of his own heart, by which he sought to know whether any hidden motive of selfish sort was swaying his will. But as a strict self-examination brought to light no conscious purpose but to glorify God in promoting the good work of the orphans and provoking to larger trust in God, and whose witness the work, it was judged to be God's will that he should go forward. November of this year, he was much encouraged by a visit from a believing brother, who bade him to go on in the work, but wisely impressed on him the need of asking for wisdom from above, at every step, seeking God's help and showing him the plain plan for the building, that all details might accord with the divine mind. Now, Robert C. Chapman of Barnesfield, yet living, and whom Mr. Mueller cherished as his older friend. On the 36th day after specific prayer had been offered about this new house on December 10, 1845, Mr. Mueller received £1,000 for this purpose, the largest sum yet received in one donation since the work had begun on March 5, 1834. Yet he was as calm and composed as though the gift had been only a shilling, having full faith in God as both guided and providing. He records that he would not have been surprised had the amount been 5 or 10 times as great. 3 days later, a Christian architect in London voluntarily offered not only to draw up the plans, but graciously to superintend the building. This offer had been bought about in a manner so strange as to be nationally regarded as a new sign and proof of God's approval of a fresh pledge of his sure help. Mr. Mueller's sister-in-law, visiting the metropolis, had met this architect, and finding him much interested to know more of that work of which he had read in the narrative. She had told him of the purpose to build, whereupon, without either solicitation or expecting on her part, this cheerful offer was made. Not only was the architect not urged by her, but he pressed his proposal himself, urged on by his deep interest in the orphan work. Thus, within 40 days, the first £1,000 had been given in answer to prayer, and a pious man, as yet unseen and unknowing by Mr. Mueller, had been led to offer his services in providing plans for the new building and superintending its erection. Surely, God was moving before his servant. For a man personally penniless to attempt to erect such a house on such a scale without appeal to man and in such sole dependence on God was no small venture of faith. The full risk involved in such an undertaking and the full force of the testimony which it has such afforded to a prayer-hearing God can be felt only as full weight of the responsibility is appreciated and all the circumstances are duly considered. First of all, ground must be bought, and it must comprise 6 or 7 acres, and the site must be on near Bristol, for Mr. Mueller's general sphere of work was in the city, and the orphans and their helpers should be within reasonable reach of their customary meeting place, and on many other accounts such nearness to the city was desirable, but such a site would cost from £2,000 to £3,000. Next, the building must be constructed, fitted up, and furnished with accommodations for 300 orphans, their overseers, teachers, and various helpers. However plain the building and its furnishing, the total cost would reach from 3 to 4 times the price of the site. Then the annual cost of keeping such a house open, of maintaining such a large body of inmates, would be £4,000 or £5,000 more. Here, then, was a prospective outlay of somewhere between £10,000 and £15,000 for the site and building, with a further expense of 1/3 as much more every year. No man so poor as Mr. George Mueller, if at the same time sane, would ever have thought of such a gigantic scheme, much less of undertaking to work it out, if his faith and hope were not fixed on God. Mr. Mueller himself confessed that here lay his old secret. He was not driven outward by any self-seeking, but drawn onward by a conviction that he would be doing the will of God. When Constantine was laying out on a vast scale the new city in Boporus, he met with the misgivings of those about him who wondered at his audacity by simply saying, quote, "I am following one who is leading me," close quote. George Mueller's scheme was not self-originated. He followed one who was leading him, and because confident and conscious of such guidance, he had only to follow, trust, and wait. Proportioned as the undertaking was great, he desired God's hand to be very clearly seen. Hence he forbore even to seem preeminent. He issued no circular, announced his purpose, and spoke of it only to a few who were in his councils, and even then only as conversation led in that direction. Remember the promise, quote, I will guide thee with my eye, close quote. And looking up to God, he saw no step unless the divine glance or beck made duty, quote, clear as daylight, close quote. And he saw the matter his whole business was to wait on God in prayer with faith and patience. The assurance became double assured that God would build for himself a large orphan house near Bristol, to show all, near and afar, what a blessed privilege it is to trust in him. He desired him, God himself, so manifestly to act as that he should be seen by all men to be nothing but his instrument, passive in his hands. Meanwhile, he went on with his daily search into the Word, where he found instruction so rich, encouragement so timely, that scriptures seemed written for his special use, to convey message to him from above. For example, in the opening of the book of Ezra, he saw how God, when his time had fully come for the return of his exiled people to their own land and for the rebuilding of his temple, used Cyrus, a Darius king, to issue an edict and provide means for carrying out his own unknown purpose. He saw also how God stirred up the people to help the returning exiles in their work, and said to himself, this same God can and will in his own way supply the money and all the needed help of man, stirring up the hearts of his own children to aid as he may please. The first donations toward the work themselves embody a suggestive lesson. On December 10th, £1,000 had been given in one sum. 20 days later, £50 more, and the next day, 3 and 6 pence followed. The same evening, by a second gift of £1,000. Shortly after, a little bag made of foreign seeds and flour wrought of shells were sent to be sold for the fund. In connection with these, last gifts of very little inherent value, a promise was quoted, which had been prominent before the giver's mind, which brought more encouragement to Mr. Mueller than any mere sum of money. Quote, who art thou, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel thou shalt become made a plain. Zechariah 4:7. Gifts, however large, were never estimated by intrinsic worth, but as tokens of God's working in the minds of his people, and of his gracious working with and through his servant. And for this reason, £1,000 cost no more sincere praise to God and no more excitement of mind than 4 pence given subsequently by a poor orphan. Specifically asking God to go before them, Mr. Mueller now began to seek a suitable site. About 4 weeks passed in seemingly fruitless search, when he was strongly impressed that very soon the Lord would give him the ground. And he was told his helpers on the evening of Saturday, January 31st, 1846, within 2 days, his mind was drawn to Ashley Down, where he could find lots singularly suited for his needs. Shortly after, he called twice on the owner, once at his house and again at his office. But on both occasions, failing to find him, he only left a message. He judged that God's hand was to be seen even in his not finding the man he sought, and that having twice failed the same day, he was not to push the matter, though self-willed, but patiently wait the morrow. When he did find the owner, his patience was unexpectedly rewarded. He, the owner, confessed that he had spent 2 wakeful hours in bed, thinking about his land and about what reply he should make to Mr. Mueller's inquiry as to its sale for an orphan house, that he had determined, if it were applied for, to ask but £120 an acre, instead of £200, his previous price. The bargain was prompted completely, and thus the Lord's servant, by not being in a hurry, saved in the purchase of the site of 7 acres, £560. Mr. Mueller had asked the Lord to go before him, and he had not done so in a sense he had not thought of, first speaking about the matter to the owner, holding his eyes waking till he had made clear to him, as his servant and steward, what he would have him do in the sale of that property. Appendix G. 6 days after, the former offer of the London architect of his services in surveying and drawing plans, elevations, selection of specifications and overseeing the work of construction, and a week later he came to Bristol, saw the site, pronounced it in all respects well fitted for its purpose. Up to June 4, 1846, the total sum in hand for the building was a little more than £2,700, a small part only of the sum needful. But Mr. Mueller felt no doubt that in God's own time, all that was required would be given. 212 days he had been waiting on God and for the way to be opened for the building. And he resolved to wait still further until the whole sum was in hand, using for the purpose only such gifts as were specified or left free for that end. He also wisely decided that others must henceforth share the burden, and that he would look out of 10 brethren of honest report, full of the Holy Spirit and of wisdom, to act as trustees to hold and administer this property in God's name. He felt that as this work was now so enlarging, and the foundations of a permanent institution were to be laid, the Christian public, who would aid its erection and support, would be entitled to representation in its conduct. At such point as this, many others have made a serious mistake, forfeiting confidence by ministering public benefactors in a private manner and an autocratic spirit, their own head being the office, in their pocket the treasury of a public benevolent institution. Satan again acted as a hinderer. After ground for the new orphan house had been found, bought, and paid for, unforeseen obstacles prevented prompt possession. But Mr. Mueller's peace was not disturbed, knowing even hindrances to be under God's control. If the Lord should allow one piece of land to be taken from him, it would only be because he was about to be giving him one still better, and so the delay would only prove his faith and perfected his patience. On July 6, £2,000 were given, twice as large as the gift had yet come in one donation, and on January 25, 1847, another like offering, so like on July 5th following, the work of the building began. 6 months later, after 400 days of waiting upon God for this new orphan house, £9,000 had been given in answer to believing prayer. As the new building approached completion with its 300 large windows, requiring full preparation for the accommodation of about 330 inmates, although above £11,000 had been provided, several thousand more were necessary. But Mr. Mueller's was not only helped, but far beyond his largest expectation. Up to May 26, 1848, these later needs existed, and had but one serious difficulty remained unremoved. The results must have been failure. But all the necessary money was obtained, and even more, all the helpers provided for the oversight of the orphans. On June 18, 1849, more than 20 years after the beginning of the work, the orphans began to be transferred from the four rented houses in Wilston Street to the new orphan houses on Ashley Down. 5 weeks passed before fresh applications were received, that everything about this new institution might first be brought into complete order by some experience in his conduct. By May 26, 1850, however, there were in the house 275 children, and the whole number of inmates was 308. The name, quote, the new orphan house, close quote, rather than the asylum, was chosen to distinguish it from another institution nearby, and particularly it was requested that it might never be known as Mr. Mueller's Orphan House, close quote, lest undue prominence be given to the one who had merely been God's instrument in its erection. He esteemed it a sin to appropriate even indirectly or allow others to attribute to him any part of the glory which belongs solely to him who had led the work, given faith and means for it, and helped in it from the first to last. The property was placed in the hands of 11 trustees chosen by Mr. Mueller, and the deeds were enrolled in Chancery. Arrangements were made that the house should be open to visitors only on Wednesday afternoons, as about 1 hour and a half were necessary to see the whole building. Scarcity were the orphans thus housed in Ashley Down. Before Mr. Mueller's heartfelt and large desire that 1,000 instead of 300 might enjoy such privilege of temporal provision and spiritual instructions, and before the new year, 1851, had dawned, this yearning had matured into a purpose. With his uniform carefulness and prayerfulness, he sought to be assured that he was not following soft will, but the will of God, and again in the scales of a pious judgment, the reasons for and against were constantly weighed. Would he be going beyond measure, close quote, spiritually or naturally? Was not the work with its very vast correspondence and responsibility already sufficiently great? Would not a new orphan house for 300 orphans cost another £15,000? Or if he built for 700 with the necessary ground, 35,000? And even when built and fitted and filled, would there not be the providing for daily wants, which a perpetual care cannot be paid for at once, like a site and building? It would demand £8,000 annually outlaid to provide for another 700 little ones. To all objections, to the one and all-sufficient answer was the all-sufficient God. Because Mr. Mueller's eye was on his power and wisdom and riches, his own weakness, folly, and poverty were forgotten. Another objection was suggested. What if he should succeed in thus housing, feeding, 1,000 poor waifs? What would become of institution after his death? The reply was memorial. Quote, my business is with all my might to serve my generation by the will of God, and so in doing, I should best serve the next generation, should the Lord tarry. Were such objection valid, it would be as valid against beginning any work likely to outlive the worker. And Mr. Mueller remembered how Franke at Holly had to meet the same objections when, now over 200 years ago, he founded the largest charitable establishment which up to 1851 existed in the world. But when, after about 30 years of personal superintendence, Franke was taken away, his son-in-law, as we have seen, became the director. That fellow countryman who had spoken to Mr. Mueller's soul in 1826, thus 25 years later, encouraged him to go forward, to do his own duty, and leave the future to the eternal God. Several reasons are recorded for Mr. Mueller, especially influencing still further advance. The many applicants that could not, for want of room, be accepted. The low morale state of the poorhouses to which these children of poverty were liable to be sent. The large number of distressing cases of orphanhood known to be deserving of help. The previous experiences of the Lord's gracious leading and of the work himself. His calmness in viewing the proposed expansion. And the spiritual blessings possible to a large number of homeless children. But one reason overtopped all others. An enlargement service to man, attempted and achieved solely in dependence upon God, would afford a correspondingly weighty witness of the hearer of prayer. These reasons, here recorded, will need no repetition in connection with subsequent expansions of the work, for at every new stage of advance, they were what influenced this servant of God. On January 4th, 1851, another offering was received of £3,000, the single largest donation up to that date, which being left entirely to his own disposal, encouraged him to go forward. Again, he kept his own counsel. Up to January 25th, he had not mentioned, even to his own wife, his thought of a further forward movement, feeling that to avoid all mistakes, he must first of all get clear light from God, and not darken it by misleading human counsel. Not until the 12th report of the Scriptural Knowledge Institution was issued, was the public appraised of his purpose, with God's help to provide for 700 more needy orphans. Up to the October 2nd, 1851, only about £1,100 had been given directly toward the Second Purpose Orphan House. And up to May 26 following, a total sum £3,500. But George Mueller remembered the one who, quote, after he had patiently endured, attained the promises, close quote. He who had waited over 2 years before all means needful for the first house had been supplied, and could wait still longer, if God so willed it, for the answers to present prayers for means to build a second. After waiting upwards of 19 months for the building fund for the second house and receiving almost daily something in answer to prayer, on January 4, 1853, he had an intimation that there was about to be paid him as a joint donation of several Christians, £8,100, of which he appropriated £6,000 for the building fund. Again, he was not surprised nor excited, but the exceeding joy and triumph in God. Just 2 years previously, recording the largest donation yet received, £3,000, he recorded also his expectation of still greater things, and now a donation between 2 and 3 times as large was about to come into his hands. It was not the amount of money, however, that gave him his overflowing delight, the fact that not in vain had his boast in God. As now, some 483 orphans were waiting for admission. He was moved to pray that soon the way might be opened for the new building to be begun. James 1:4 was deeply impressed upon him in the injunction now to be kept before him, quote, "But let patience have her perfect work, that ye may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing," close quote. On May 26, 1853, the total sum available for the new building was about £12,500, and over 500 orphans had applied. Twice this sum would be needed, however, before the new house could be begun without risk of debt. On January 8, 1855, several Christian friends united in the promise that £5,700 should be paid by him for the work of God, and of this, $3,400 was by him set apart for the building fund. As there were now between 700 and 800 applicants, it seemed of God that at least a site should be secured for another new orphan house, and a few weeks later Mr. Mueller applied for the purchase of 2 fields adjoining the site of the first house. As they could not, however, be sold at that time, the only resource was to be believed that the Lord had other purposes, would give better ground that were on which the servant had set his mind. Further thought and prayer suggested to him that the 2 houses could be built instead of one, and located on each side of the existing building, upon the ground already owned. Accordingly, it was determined to begin on the south side the erection of a house to accommodate 400 orphans, there being money in the bank, or soon be available, sufficient to build it, fit up, and furnish it. On May 26, 1856, nearly £30,000 were in hand for the new orphan house number 2, and on November 12, 1857, this house opened for 400 additional orphans, and there was a balance of nearly £3,300. The God who provided the building furnished the helpers, without either difficulty or advertising. With the beginning of the new year, Mr. Mueller began to lay aside £600 as first appropriate for the third orphan house. And the steps which led to the accomplishment of this work also were identical with the taken hereto up. A purchase was made of additional ground adjoining the 2 buildings, and as there were so many applicants, the cost of providing for a larger number would be but a little more. It determined to build so as to receive 450 instead of 300, rejoicing that in every enlargement of the work, it would be more apparent how much one poor man, simply trusting God, could bring about by prayer, and that the other children of God might be led to carry on the work of God and dependent solely on Him, and generally to trust more in all circumstances and positions. Orphan House No. 3 was opened March 12, 1862, with other £10,000 in hand for current expenses. All the helpers needed had not then been supplied, but this delay was not only a new incentive to believing prayer. Instead of once, thrice a day, God was besought to provide suitable persons. One after another was thus added, and in no case too late, so that the reception of children was not hindered, nor was the work embarrassed. Still, further enlargement seemed needful, for the same reasons as previously. There was an increased demand for accommodation of applications, and past experience of God's wondrous dealings urged him both to attempt and expect greater things. God's Orphan House No. 3 and 5 began to loom up above his horizon of faith. By May 26, 1862, he had over £6,600 to apply in their erection. In November 1864, a large donation of £5,000 was received from a donor who would neither let his name nor residence be known. And by his time, about £27,000 had thus accumulated toward the £50,000 required. As more than half the requisite sum was thus in hand, the purchase of a site might safely be made for the foundations for the building having been laid. Mr. Mueller's eyes had, for years, been laid upon laying adjoining the three houses already built, separation from them only by the turnpike road. He called to see the agent and found that the property was subject to a lease that had yet 2 years to run. This obstacle only incited to new prayer, but difficulties seemed to increase. The price asked was too high, and the Bristol Water Works Company was negotiating for the same price of land for reservoir purposes. Nevertheless, God successfully removed all hindrances, so that the ground was bought and conveyed to the trustees in March 1865, and after the purchase money was paid, about £25,000 yet remained for the structures. Both the cost and the inconvenience of building would be greatly lessened by erecting both houses at the same time, and God was therefore asking for the ample means speedily to complete the whole work. In May 1866, over £34,000 being at Mr. Mueller's disposal, No. 4 was commenced, and in January following, No. 5 also. Up to the end of March 1867, over £50,000 had been supplied, leaving but £6,000 more needful to fit and furnish the two buildings for occupancy. By the opening of February 1868, £58,000 in all had been donated, so that on November 5, 1868, New Orphan House No. 4 and on January 6, 1870, No. 5 were thrown open, a balance of several thousand pounds remaining for general purposes. Thus, early in 1870, the orphan work had reached its complete outfit, and five large buildings are nationally down, with accommodation for 2,000 orphans, for all needed teachers and assistants. Thus, having been granted into one chapter the facts about the erection of the great monument to a prayer-hearing God in Ashley Down, through the work of building covered so many years between the first decision to build in 1845 and the opening of the third house in 1862. Nearly 16 years had elapsed, and before No. 5 was open in 1870, 25 years. The work was one in its plan and purpose. At each new stage, it supplies only a wider application and illustration of the same laws of life and principles of conduct. As for the outset of the work in Bristol, had with growing power controlled George Mueller. His one supreme aim was the glory of God, his one sole resort, believing prayer, his one trusted oracle, the inspired word, his one divine teacher, the Holy Spirit. One step taken in faith and prayer had prepared for another. One act of trust had made him bolder to venture upon another, implying a greater apparent risk, and therefore demanding more implicit trust. But answered prayer was rewarded faith, and every new risk only showed that there was no risk in confidently leaning upon the truth and faithfulness of God. One cannot be impressed in visiting the orphan houses with several prominent features, and first of all their magnitude. They are very spacious, with about 1,700 large windows, and accommodations for over 2,000 inmates. They are all very substantial, being built of stone made to last. They are scrupulously plain. Utility rather than beauty seems conspicuous stamped upon them. Within and without, economy has been manifestly a ruling law in their construction. The furniture is equally unpretentious, unostentatious, and as to garnishing, there is absolutely none. To some few, they are almost too destitute of embellishment. Mr. Mueller has been blamed for not introducing some aesthetic features which might relieve this bald utilitarianism that has served to educate the taste of these orphans. To all such criticisms, there are but two or three adequate answers. First, Mr. Mueller subordinates everything to his one great purpose, the demonstration of the fact that the living God is the hearer of prayer. Second, he felt himself to be steward of God's property, and he hesitated to spend one penny on what was necessity to the frugal carrying on of the work of God. He felt that all could be spared without injury to health, a proper mental training, and a thorough scriptural and spiritual education should be reserved for the relief of the necessities of the poor and destitute elsewhere. And again, he felt that these orphans were likely to be put at service in plain homes, and compelled to live frugally any surroundings which would accustom them to indulge refined taste might by contrast make them discontent with their future lot. And so he studied to promote simply their health and comfort, and to school them to contentment when the necessities of life were supplied. But more than this, a moment's seriousness thought will show that had he surrounded them with those elegancies which elaborate architectures and other fine arts furnish, he might have been even more severely criticized. He would have been spending the gifts of the poor, who are often sorely denied themselves for the sake of these orphans, to purchase embellishments or secure decorations, which, if they had adorned the humble homes of thousands of donors, would have made their gifts impossible. When we remember how many offerings, numbering tens of thousands, were like the widow's mite, very small themselves, yet relative to ability very large, it will be seen how incredulous it would have been seen to use the gifts, save only by limiting even the wants of the givers, to buy for orphans what the donors could not and would not afford for themselves. Cleanness, neatness, method, and order, however, everywhere reigned, and honest labor has always had at the orphans' houses a certain dignity. The tracts of land adjoining the buildings are set apart as a vegetable gardens, where wholesome exercise is provided for the boys, orphan boys, and at the same time, work that helps provide daily food, thus train them in part to self-support. Throughout these houses, studious care is exhibited as to methodical arrangement. Each child has a square and numbered compartment for clothes. Six orphans being told off at a time in each section to take charge. The boys have each three suits, and the girls five dresses each. the girls being taught to make and mend their own garments. In the nursery, the infant children have books and playthings to occupy and amuse them, and there are the objects of tender maternal care. Several children are often admitted to the orphanages from one family, in order to avoid needless breaking of household ties by separation. The average term of residence is about 10 years, though some orphans have been there for 17. The daily life is laid out with regularity, and it goes on like clockwork in punctuality. The children rise at 6 and are expected to be ready at 7, the girls for knitting, the boys for reading, until 8 o'clock. When breakfast is served half an hour later, there is a brief morning service, and the school begins at 10. Half an hour recreation in the playground prepares for the 1 o'clock dinner, and the school is resumed until 4. Then comes an hour and a half of playing or outdoor exercise, a half hour service preceding the 6 hour clock meal. Then the girls ply the needle, and the boys are in school until bedtime, the younger children going to rest at 8 and the older at 9. The food is simple, ample, nutritious, consisting of bread, oatmeal, milk, soups, meat, rice, and vegetables. Everything is adjusted to one ultimate end. To use Mr. Mueller's own words, quote, "We aim at this, that if any of them do not turn out as well temporally or spiritually, and do not become useful members of society, shall it at least not be our fault." The most thorough and careful examination of the whole methods of the institution will only satisfy the visitor that it will not be the fault of those who superintend this work. If the orphans are not well fitted, body and soul, for the work of life, and are not prepared for the blessed immortality.